Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is entrapment. You are sending informants into a impoverished community, the most impoverished county, to do your trickery. You ain't stumbled upon a cell. Nobody ain't tell you that someone was plotting to do anything. You created a crime.
For the past 14 years, relatives of four men jailed on terrorism charges in Newburgh, New York, have accused the FBI of entrapment. On Thursday, a federal judge agreed and ordered the release of three of the men. In a stunning decision, the judge accused the FBI of inventing a conspiracy. We'll speak to two attorneys who spent over a decade trying to win the freedom of the Newburgh Four. Then a former OBGYN at Columbia University, Robert Haddon, has been sentenced to 20 years in a federal prison. He's accused of sexually assaulting hundreds of patients during examinations over two decades. We'll speak to two survivors and look at why Columbia ignored Haddon's behavior for so long.
I was the first person to speak publicly about being sexually assaulted by Robert Haddon, including when I was pregnant with my twin daughters. I was fortunate to be in court last week to watch the sentencing in his federal trial. It is certainly a milestone in what has been a many years-long quest for justice.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, at least 54 people were killed, 200 injured Sunday as explosions rocked a political rally in the northwestern Bajor district, which borders Afghanistan. The deadly blast was triggered by a suicide bomber during a gathering of the conservative Jamiat Ulema Ismail Faisal party, which is part of Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif's ruling coalition. The bombing came amidst mounting insecurity ahead of elections planned for November. No one's yet claimed responsibility for the attack, though police said the Islamic State group could be to blame. A number of children died in the attack. Russia says it shot down three Ukrainian drones over Moscow Sunday, two of which damaged a high-rise building that may house government offices. It's the latest in a series of similar attacks the Kremlin has blamed on Kyiv. This is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Gradually, the war is returning to the territory of Russia, to its symbolic centers and military bases, and this is an inevitable, natural, and absolutely fair process.
On Saturday, Russian strikes killed at least two people in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Sumy and two people in Zaporizhia. Meanwhile, Deputy Security Council Chair and former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said there would be no other option but to launch a nuclear attack if Ukraine is successful in its NATO-backed counteroffensive. Elsewhere, Poland sounded the alarm over Wagner forces in Belarus, which it says are moving closer to the Polish border. Following the Russia-Africa summit last week in St. Petersburg, Russian President Vladimir Putin said a peace initiative presented by African leaders could be the basis for ending the war if Ukraine ceased its attacks. Meanwhile, the African Union said Putin's offer to supply some African countries with grain was not sufficient to guarantee a stable food supply.
President Putin said he was ready to help us with grain supplies. It is important, but maybe not enough. We need to achieve a ceasefire, because it is always something unpredictable. And the longer it is, the more unpredictable it becomes.
In Chad, tens of thousands of refugees who fled violence in Sudan face another lethal threat, shortages of running water amid scorching temperatures. Sudanese refugees say the little water they have access to is needed for drinking, leaving little for toilets and sanitation.
We wait for water for 6 hours and we spend the whole day here, overcrowded. There are water cuts, heat, hunger, thirst, and the water containers are limited. We have no pots, mattresses, blankets, or covers. We spend the day in the heat. Whether you come to get water, it's hot, or you sit in the tent, it's also hot.
As heat waves envelop the globe, here in the United States, the Conference of Mayors and the National League of Cities are calling on Congress to pass the Extreme Heat Emergency Act. The bill would add extreme heat and wildfire smoke events to a list of disasters that can unlock supplemental assistance from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. On Thursday, a youth activist confronted White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre over President Biden's approval of new coal, oil and gas projects. This is Elise Joshi, executive director of Gen Z for Change.
Will the administration stop approving new oil and gas projects and align with youth, science, and frontline communities from the North Slope of Alaska to Louisiana?
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre then proceeded in a defense of the Biden administration before being interrupted again by Joshi.
You have approved multiple projects since then and more at a faster rate than the Trump administration. We need you to act on your campaign promises.
Declare a climate emergency.
In British Columbia, a third firefighter has died battling Canada's worst wildfire season on record, which has scorched some 30 million acres, an area larger than the nation of Cuba. Millions of Canadians and more than 120 million people across the United States have faced air quality alerts this summer due to smoke from the fires. In Turkey, security forces have unleashed water cannons and tear gas on villagers and activists protecting the Akbelen forest in the province of Mula from being cleared for coal mining. At least 14 people were arrested last week. Local communities, environmental groups have brought legal challenges and put their own bodies on the line in an attempt to stop YK Energy's expansion of open pit mining in Akbelen. An activist with the group Beyond Fossil Fuels said, quote, as tens of thousands of people across the Mediterranean region flee rampaging wildfires caused by the climate crisis, it's incomprehensible that a company is allowed to destroy a forest, one of our most important carbon sinks, to expand a coal mine, they said. The head of Niger's presidential guard has declared himself the leader of a transitional government following Wednesday's coup d'etat, which deposed the West African nation's democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum. On Friday, General Abdurrahman Tchiani said on state-run television, the coup was necessary to prevent the gradual and inevitable demise of Niger. Over the weekend, ECOWAS, a bloc of 15 West African nations, slapped sanctions on leaders of the coup and threatened to expel them by force unless they cede power within a week. On Sunday, thousands of supporters of the junta attempted to storm the French embassy in the capital, Niamey, burning French flags and chanting slogans against Niger's former colonial ruler. They were turned away by soldiers firing tear gas. Many Nigerians are rejecting the interference of foreign actors following the coup.
The international community that says it's here for us, we don't want it. We don't want its moral lesson, because it's no longer credible in the eyes of Africans. We can't understand why they support a coup d'etat in Chad and oppose them in Mali and Burkina Faso. It's an internal problem, which only concerns Nigerians. If we call on them, they can cooperate with us, but we don't want their moral lessons.
In Kenya, the government of President William Ruto and the opposition coalition agreed to establish a joint committee to, quote, resolve their differences following deadly protests earlier this month. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called the protests over the high cost of living and tax hikes on Friday. An appeals court lifted a freeze on the contested tax law, which doubles fuel taxes and introduces a new housing levy. Some activists have questioned the court's move.
We are fearing that there is an executive interference in that ruling, because prior to this, we saw the executive come out boldly condemning the courts, declaring the courts that the courts are against the government. The courts are being used by external forces.
In Lebanon, at least five people were killed Sunday during clashes between rival groups in one of the largest Palestinian refugee camps near the city of Sidon. The fighting broke out after an unknown gunman tried to assassinate an Islamist militant leader, killing a companion instead. In response, militants killed a military general and three other members of the Fatah group, which is part of the Palestinian Authority. At least seven people were also wounded in the violence, including at least two children. Palestinian factions in the camp have for years cracked down on militant Islamist groups. The overcrowded Ain el-Hilwa camp houses some 55,000 Palestinians. In related news, the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and the leader of Hamas have formed a reconciliation committee aimed at uniting rival Palestinian political movements. Abbas and Ismail Haniyeh met for rare in-person talks in Egypt Sunday, along with the heads of other Palestinian groups. Hamas, which runs a parallel government in the besieged Gaza Strip, has called on the Palestinian Authority to end its security collaboration with Israel and cease the detention of political prisoners. The group has also called for the formation of an inclusive Palestinian parliament through democratic elections. Friction between Hamas and Fatah, the dominant party in the Palestinian Authority, has persisted since 2007 after violence erupted between the two groups over control of Palestinian territories. In the United States, the Justice Department has launched a civil rights investigation into the Memphis police. This is Kristen Clark, Assistant Attorney General at the DOJ.
We received multiple reports of officers escalating encounters with community members, resulting in excessive force. There are also indications that officers may use force punitively when faced with behavior they perceive to be insolent. The information we reviewed also shows that officers may use force against people who are already restrained or in custody.
The targeting and abuse of black residents by Memphis police came under a national spotlight following the January killing of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black man who was pepper sprayed and fatally beaten by police during a traffic stop. And a federal judge has blocked an Arkansas law that would allow criminal charges against librarians and booksellers for providing, quote unquote, harmful materials to children and teens. The law, signed by Republican governor, former Trump spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders in March, would have gone into effect tomorrow, Tuesday. The ACLU filed the lawsuit on behalf of various Arkansas libraries, bookstores, librarians, and readers. 17-year-old plaintiff, high school student Hayden Kirby, said, quote, "I want to fight for our rights to intellectual freedom and ensure that libraries remain spaces where young Arkansans can explore diverse perspectives," she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, in a stunning decision, a federal judge has ordered the release of three New York men who were entrapped by the FBI and sentenced to 25 years in prison for their role in a government-orchestrated bombing plot. Stay with us. Godspeed you, Black Emperor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has ordered the release of three New York men who were sentenced to 25 years in prison for their role in a government-orchestrated bombing plot. The men, who were all Black and Muslim converts, became known as the Newburgh Four. They were convicted in 2010 and sentenced to 25 years in prison for placing what they thought were bombs in a New York synagogue. Supporters of the men have long argued they were entrapped by the government. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Colleen McMahon issued a stunning ruling ordering the compassionate release of three of the four men. In her ruling, she wrote, quote, "A person reading the crimes of conviction in this case would be left with the impression that the offending defendants were sophisticated international terrorists committed to jihad against the United States. However, they were, in actual reality, hapless, easily manipulated, penurious, petty criminals." McMahon said the men were not terrorists, but, quote, "impoverished, small-time grifters and drug users, street-level dealers who could use some money." She wrote, quote, "The FBI invented the conspiracy, identified the targets, manufactured the ordnance," unquote. The FBI has relied on an informant who was involved in several other high-profile entrapment cases within the Muslim community. Democracy Now! Has closely followed the case of the Newburgh Four since 2010, when Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat and Hani Massoud and Jackie Suwin of Big Noise Films traveled through Muslim communities in New York and New Jersey to track the Newburgh case and two other entrapment cases. In October 2010, Democracy Now! Aired a special investigation into these cases. This clip begins with Anjali Kamat.
On May 20th, 2009, four African-American men from the city of Newburgh, New York, were arrested outside a synagogue in the Bronx. Known as the Newburgh Four, they made national headlines as stark examples of homegrown terror.
Prosecutors described the suspects as extremely violent men who embraced every opportunity for terrorism.
More than a year after their arrest, the Newburgh Four are now facing trial in Manhattan for conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction and anti-aircraft missiles. But the cases raise serious questions about the government's role in creating and then foiling fake terror plots.
The suspects were duped. The bombs and missile were fake, supplied by the FBI and NYPD.
Alicia McCollum is the aunt of David Williams, one of the Newburgh Four. Since his arrest, she's tried to mobilize support for her nephew. Taking the train to the first day of the trial in August, she's visibly upset.
I was restless last night. I couldn't even sleep. You know, it was just so much. You know, you think about the family and what you're getting ready to go through. And it's like this whole year fighting for the case. And now it's like finally happening. We're going to trial. And just worry, you know, that the government, you know, want to make a case so bad that my nephew can go away for life. So it's just been like heavy on my mind last night. Very heavy.
Like the other members of the Newburgh Four, 29-year-old David Williams lived in the economically devastated city of Newburgh and had served prison time on drug charges and petty criminal offenses. All four men were converts to Islam, and one of them, Laguerre Payen, is a Haitian-born immigrant and a paranoid schizophrenic. Alicia says she was shocked when she heard that these four men were being called terrorists.
That was an excerpt from the 2010 Democracy Now! Investigation by Anjali Kamat and Jackie Suwin. Alicia McWilliams McCollum went on to directly accuse the government of entrapping her nephew.
This is entrapment. You want to send an informant into a impoverished community, the most impoverished county, to do your trickery. You ain't stumbled upon a cell. Nobody ain't tell you that someone was plotting to do anything. You created a crime.
That was Alicia McWilliams McCollum speaking in 2010. She died last year after fighting for over a decade for the release of her nephew, David Williams, and the other members of the Newburgh Four. Well, David Williams, Anta Williams, Laguerre Payen will now be released within 90 days after last week's stunning judicial ruling. We're joined now by two lawyers who are part of the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, which was founded in 2010 to challenge preemptive prosecution and the post-9/11 targeting, surveillance and criminalization of Muslim communities. Kathy Manley is legal director for the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, and Stephen Downs is the chair of the Coalition's Board of Directors, former chief attorney for the Commission on Judicial Conduct in New York State. Stephen Downs and Kathy Manley, welcome to Democracy Now! Kathy Manley, why don't we start with you? The significance of this ruling yesterday by the federal judge. Tell us exactly what she said and how this came about after, what, it's been over well over a decade.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. Thanks for having us. It was, at first, I got to say, it was so poignant to hear Alicia's voice because she was at the heart of the support for these men all these years. She brought a lot of us together. She inspired us. And when we filed this motion, she was still alive. And we really, really wanted her to see this, to see them get released. And unfortunately, that wasn't to be. Hopefully she's up there smiling. But this is a significant ruling. This was a wonderful decision. It took a year and a half to happen, but we're so happy that the judge was, she always understood this case was unfair. She called it the unterrorism case from day one. And she always understood that the 25-year mandatory minimum sentence was way too harsh. But there was nothing, she believed there was nothing she could do about it because basically there is no entrapment defense in the law, and I can talk about that if I have time, but there was no way for her to avoid doing this, she believed. And when we filed this motion, that gave her an opportunity in a compassionate release motion to say this sentence is too harsh, and she did say so. And it is a wonderful ruling because it shows that the government created this entire case. You know, the judge is saying this. This is what we've been saying all along. She couldn't say it was entrapment because there's no entrapment defense. The law doesn't consider this entrapment, but it is entrapment. It's the classic definition of entrapment. And we're just really grateful that she understood the unfairness of this case. And now they will be released.
Stephen Downs, if you can lay out the case for us, and also let's be clear that the judge, Judge Colleen McMahon, is the original judge, right? She has basically reversed her decision.
Yeah. Thank you, Amy, for having us on. This is a wonderful Democracy Now! Has stood with us for years in calling out the unfairness of this case. And I think people were onto it very early. What simply happened was that the government sent down their key man, Shahid Hussein, who had entrapped people up in Albany and had nothing better to do with him. So they sent him down to hang out in a mosque in Newburgh. And the mosque very quickly caught on to him that he was a phony and a government informant, and they kicked him out. So he went out into the parking lot and began to talk to anybody he could find. So let's do jihad. Let's get involved. I'm incredibly rich. I've got money, money, money. And he hooked some guy who was Cromedy, who got interested in this, not because I think he was at all interested in jihad, but because he was interested in the money. And they talked off and on, and Cromedy backed out after a while. And then Shahid Hussein realized that he was going to lose this fish that he had hooked unless he upped it. And so he came back to him with an offer saying, I'll pay $250,000. And he later tried to deny that in a lie, and the government allowed him to do that. But there's a tape recording. I was actually making that offer, $250,000. And so they decided to go ahead with this plot. I believe Cromedy all along intended to try to get the money and not to do anything, not to harm anybody, because that was not his nature. Just before they... plot was to go down a few weeks before, the government suddenly realized that they wanted more people. They wanted to entrap larger numbers. It wouldn't look good if they were just entrapping one person. So they told Cromedy he needed some lookouts. And so he went out and hired and recruited these three young kids who just needed money. And in one case, certainly in David Williams' case, he desperately needed the money to get his brother a liver transplant. And so they joined in for a very brief time, and then the whole thing came down on top of them. There was, I think, never any doubt that the whole purpose of this was the government trying to buy crime with money, offering money to get the crime. It had nothing to do with terrorism. It had nothing to do with protecting a community against a group of people. What I find really offensive about it was that they then took these entrapment cases and turned them on the Muslim community and used it to generate hatred against the Muslim community by making all sorts of lies and exaggerated statements about what the case was about. They became a purveyor of hate, really, against the Muslim community. And the government has absolutely no business doing that. So that's how it happened.
In 2014, HBO aired the documentary The Newberg Sting, which featured secret recordings of conversations between the undercover FBI informant Shahid Hussein and James Cromedy, one of the men who became part of the Newberg Four. You have to listen really carefully because some of the audio can be hard to understand. The clip begins with James Cromedy.
None of these brothers got jobs, huh?
Uh-huh.
Only three of us without no jobs.
Sure.
But actually, how do you think we feel, huh? We getting ready to do all this, huh? We ain't got no money in our pockets, huh? How do you think we feel? Look at me, brother.
Uh-huh.
How do you think they feel?
If these brothers are doing for money, I don't need them. Subhanallah.
No, I talked to them okay. Already. They already know.
Yeah, okay.
And they're not even worried about
it. It is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that's all it is. And if they won't need for money or greediness, or they think they're going to make any money or angerness, please do not, because this is jihad. This is jihad. And that's what jihad is.
But you know what they think, huh?
Uh-huh.
They can use the money, though.
So, and that's FBI informant Shahid Hussein and James Cromedy, one of the men who became part of the Newberg Four. Kathy Manley, if you can talk about who the FBI informant was, the fact that he had what? He had fled Pakistan, perhaps wanted for murder. He didn't want to be deported. So he was desperate to entrap these men or do what the FBI wanted.
Yeah, he was at one point wanted for murder in Pakistan. I don't know the details of that, but after having seen his trajectory in the U.S., it's a long trail of slime. Like, he just kept ripping people off, conning people, tricking people out of their money, and then eventually was caught in a case where he was defrauding the DMV. He was getting people fake driver's licenses, working with a corrupt DMV employee, and the FBI was going to send him to prison and then deport him to Pakistan. But instead, they gave him an opportunity to work for them in Albany, in our case, the case of Yasin Arif and Mohammed Hossein. And he did very successfully, wrongfully prosecute them. He's so deceptive and slimy. And they ended up getting convicted and sentenced to 15 years. And we thought, this guy is so dishonest, and the jury hated him. They probably won't use him again. But sure enough, we found out they used him in the Newberg case, and they used him in other cases. The FBI loves this guy. And after the Newberg case, they used him in the Khalifa al-Akili case in Pittsburgh. And that was featured in the documentary T-Error, by Lyric Cabral and David Sutcliffe. And that actually featured the clip of of Shahid Hussein offering James Cromedy the $250,000 when he didn't realize he was being recorded. So this guy, then he went on to form this limousine company in the Albany, the capital region. And that was very tragically the limousine that killed 20 people in Schoharie County in 2018. And he was in Pakistan at that point, letting his son run the company and basically telling him how to do it, telling him, don't worry if the brakes don't work. It doesn't really matter. We don't care. And his son is now doing 5 to 15 year sentence while he sits in Pakistan hanging out with his super rich brother Malik, who kind of destabilized the government in Pakistan. So this guy has a long history.
So, Stephen Downs, let's end with you. You have 3 of 4 of the Newberg Four going to be released within 90 days, compassionate release. What happens with Cromedy, the fourth? And then the fact that this FBI informant who did a sting operation in Albany, the Fort Dix Five, Pittsburgh, does this all begin to unravel these cases?
Well, first of all, I just saw a letter from Cromedy's lawyer that he's sending to the court asking to be appointed to represent him. So I'm pretty sure that Cromedy is going to make a move to also be released. Of course, his case is different than the others. All the cases are slightly different, so he will have to present that to the court. But I think it looks pretty good that the judge will grant that. In terms of the second part of that, there's a lot of cases that look like this case. This is a particularly clear, dramatic example of it. But this was the government standard operating procedure right after 9/11. They were out there going to create as many terrorists as they could to show the public, I think, that they were on the job, that they knew what they were doing, that they were keeping America safe. And if they couldn't find any real terrorists, and they couldn't, there really weren't any real terrorists around, they had to create them. And that's what they did. They created these terrorists. So we have a lot of cases out there. The Fort Dix Five is one. The Holy Land Five is another case. Afia Siddiqui is another case. You can go down a whole long list of these cases. And some of them, and particularly the Holy Land Five and the Fort Dix Five, have